Well, good evening, everyone. Sorry about the slight delay. I just came from a class. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Alexis Heraclides, Professor Heraclides, this evening. Alexis is, since 2005, has been Professor of International Relations and Conflict Analysis at the Department of Political Science and History at the Pantheon University of Social and Political Sciences in Athens. From 1993 onwards, he was Senior Lecturer and Associate Professor at the same university. Previously, he held the post of Counselor for Minorities and Human Rights at the Greek Foreign Ministry, and that was from 1983 to 1997. And in that capacity, participated in a number of intergovernmental conferences and meetings, notably in the context of the CSCE, OSCE, as well as the United Nations, and the European Community and the Council of Europe. He was also appointed as alternate expert at the UN Subcommission on the Prevention of Discrimination and Protection of Minorities. He holds a BA in Political Science from the Pantheon School of Political Science and an MSc in International Relations from the University of London. And this is where we have a particularly close connection, a PhD from the University of Kent at Canterbury. Alexis and I both shared the same PhD supervisor, Professor John Groom. And so it sort of gives particular pleasure to be sat here this evening with Alexis. His main publications cover secessionist conflicts, self-determination, external involvement in separatist wars, and the Conference or Organization on Security and Cooperation in Europe, and specific conflicts from a conflict resolution perspective, such as Kosovo, South Sudan, and Israeli-Palestinian conflict. From 1996 onwards, his main research concerns have been the Cyprus question, Greek-Turkish conflict, and images of perceptions in Greek foreign policy. He has written 3 books in English and 10 in Greek and some 60 papers in academic journals and edited volumes. His latest book, The Greek-Turkish Conflict in the Aegean, Imagined Enemies, has just been published by Palgrave Macmillan. Alexis will be speaking this evening on Imagined Enemies, in quest of the deeper reasons for Greek-Turkish antagonism.
Right, James, thank you very much, and thank you for the invitation. I would like to make a small correction in the title. It states that in the quest of deeper reasons for the Greek-Turkish antagonism. Now, I was carried away by the term antagonism in Greek, which means rivalry, while antagonism in English is much more poignant, much more, it means coming to blows. So that was not my intention. Antagonism was not one of the words that I would have looked up into in a dictionary, because I thought it meant simply antagonism, rivalry like in Greek. Now, since 1999, Greek-Turkish relations are no more in a state of antagonism as they used to be from 74 to 99. Technically, they're in a state of détente. Yet, despite these 12 years of détente, relations remain uneasy, strained, closer to rivalry, I would say, than to a rapprochement. 3 features make rivalry, to my mind at least, the order of the day. First of all, the rivalry comprises an extended agenda. It's Aegean, Cyprus, minorities, the patriarchate in Istanbul, and so on. And all this agenda has not been, nothing has been settled despite the 12 years of détente and the various attempts that have taken place previously. The periods of détente were unable to pave the way for rapprochement or for reconciliation. And that's quite amazing because the previous rapprochement and reconciliation that had taken place in 1930, to be exact, had taken place after events that were tragic, with great confrontations, wars, and so on, 1919 to 22, the Greek-Turkish War, and a forced eviction of population. Tragic event led to reconciliation, while in this case, we do not have a reconciliation. I would add that the rivalry and ill feeling continues, despite the fact that it's very costly for both parties. Armaments, dangerous dogfights over the Aegean, and valuable diplomatic and other capital that could have been spent more productively elsewhere is being spent in the ongoing rivalry. However, at the first glance, and it's something that outsiders and foreigners come up with, the Greek-Turkish rivalry appears perplexing. The reasons for its continuation are not immediately obvious, as pointed out by a number of people, and in particular by Richard Clogg, way back in the late 70s and early 80s. Now, why is this persistent not immediately obvious? One reason is that the borders between the two countries have been set conclusively in the 1923 Lausanne Treaty and the Paris Treaty, and the remaining outstanding boundary differences, namely those in the Aegean, are on water and on air and are more amenable to a settlement. There are no claims to the territory of the other side, as was the case until 1922. And both sides have officially claimed, since 1929 to be exact, that they harbor no territorial ambitions vis-à-vis the other side. And we have another reason for the perplexing aspect of the conflict is that there have been several decades of cordial relations in the 1930s, from 1945 to 1954, and the recent 12 years as a result of political will at the highest possible level, which implies that rapprochement as distinct is a distinct possibility, what psychologists would call a cognitive alternative. Yet the Turkish-Greek rivalry drifts with remarkable abandon. Could it be, as Henry Kissinger had once put it, that the rivalry is centuries old and emotional and defies rationality? Its settlement defies rationality. In both countries, there are many experts, diplomats, politicians, and so on, who regard the conflict as a given, as inevitable, as bound to continue, if you want, till the end of times, as it were. I would call this approach the sort of Carl Schmitt type of approach, that the enemy is always the enemy, can never become a friend and ally, and so on. And this is a position taken by what we would roughly call the hawks and hardliners on either side of the Aegean. According to this logic, the only thing that we can do is either to diplomatically overwhelm the other side, if not militarily, but basically diplomatically, what I would call to outwit and outsmart the other side, which would be fall under IR theory, more or less in traditional hard realism, and the more softer approach would put emphasis on crisis management. However, those that have dealt with the Greek-Turkish conflict in greater depth, and again they include diplomats, politicians, and experts, would claim that in fact the Greek-Turkish rivalry is not a given, it can be overcome, and the various issues can be resolved with, of course, mutual concessions on either side. Now, those that have taken this line, who would fall roughly under what would be one version of realism or pluralism and liberalism or constructivism and so on, would point out to three possible avenues as to how to deal with the Greek-Turkish rivalry. I'm talking about practical approaches to the matter. One path is to settle the Cyprus conflict, which is the initial conflict, the initial event, the initial difficulty that derailed the cordial relations between Greece and Turkey, which had continued from the 30s to the 40s, and in particular the first part of the 50s. The date when the Cyprus problem derailed the relations is September, October 54, with Greece putting the matter of Cyprus to the UN General Assembly. Hence, relations have been poisoned again and again, and the two parties have never been able to overcome the situation and move forward to a reconciliation. So according to this logic, you must try and resolve the Cyprus conflict, and then you can, and all the rest will be, if you want, child's play. However, the problem is that the Cyprus problem might not be resolved, at least not by reunification. It will remain, Cyprus might remain divided, at least for the foreseeable future. So it's not a very realistic to put this, the resolution of the Cyprus problem before the resolution of the settlement and the rapprochement between the two countries. Incidentally, on the Greek side, this approach of putting ahead the Cyprus problem was very much an approach held by Konstantinos Mitsotakis, and in its more assertive or forceful rendition by Andreas Papandreou. And as for the Turkey, it would not put forward this position. The dominant line until the AK Parti took over was Ecevit's line that Cyprus has been resolved in 1974, which was also a position taken by Kissinger. Skeptics of this approach, of course, would point out that we should not put forward Cyprus as a prerequisite for Cyprus might not be resolved. So what would be the obvious outcome is decoupling. So you decouple the Cyprus conflict from the Greek-Turkish relations and try to take the threat from that point onwards. A second path, from the practical point of view, as I mentioned, is to take the bull by the horns, if I could use this not very nice expression, and try and resolve the main outstanding difficulties, and the main outstanding difficulty is the one of the Aegean. This was a position taken by a number of Greek politicians at the highest possible level in the 70s by Konstantin Karamanlis and Ecevit, when in power, not in opposition in the case of Ecevit, and in the early 2000s by Kostas Simitis. And in fact, there were times in the late 70s, and in particular in the early 2000s, where there was a meeting of mind and a certain convergence as to how points of convergence and agreed principles as to how to resolve the Aegean question. Now, critics of this approach would point out that these two attempts led to naught. There were no concrete results, partly because the issues are very complex. The internal cost factor was also very important, and governments avoided taking the plunge and coming up with what would have been a middle position, and there would have obviously been a number of concessions on either side. This leads us to the third part, low politics, economic cooperation, tourism, contacts, and so on. The hope here is that after two, three decades of low politics, the Aegean and other issues will appear more less salient, I was a Freudian slip perhaps, more amenable to a settlement, desecuritized, and some issues may simply disappear from the agenda. Now, skeptics of this approach point out that it remains an open question whether the functional or neo-functional logic of this approach can win the day. Economic transactions per se can be antagonistic. If the Aegean dispute is not resolved, there can always be some kind of Aegean crisis which might run out of hand. Cyprus, it can always be counted to poison their relations and so on. And in any event, it remains very doubtful whether the economic cooperation can have that famous spillover effect mentioned by neo-functionalists and end up by being able to tackle the more difficult high politics. Of course, it remains, it's something that I've been told by a number of Greek and Turkish economists as well as industrialists, I have more links with diplomats and industrialists, just to clarify the point, that the fact that this economic cooperation, which is still thriving, is probably the basic thing that we have in our hands, and it might possibly act as a safety net if things do not get very sour, very terrible, but it could act as a safety net to be able to to tackle the more secondary issues. But on its own, it cannot probably have the result that we want. I would argue, and this is a position that I have taken in my works on the Greek-Turkish conflict in the last 10 years, and it's a view shared by a number of others, in particular by one well-known scholar who was my inspiration, Hercules Milas, that the main reason why there cannot be a movement ahead is that the objective conflict of interest, if you want, Cyprus, the Aegean, and so on, is but the peak of the iceberg. That behind that, underneath that, we have the iceberg, the huge iceberg, which consists of imagined history, glories and traumas, coupled with the chosen collective identity of each side, which needs the other, but needs the other as the enemy, as the demon. Now, this is the main theme of my presentation. Now, historical narratives. One of the most enduring beliefs in both countries is that the conflict commenced way back in 1871, that it's a kind of primordial conflict, which goes back many centuries. In fact, their first meeting of the two prospective nations, Greeks and Turks, is at Manzikert, the Armenian city of Manzikert, back in 1071. And this was an encounter at the battlefield, and this continued, this clash between the two peoples, between the two civilizations, until 1453, the conquest of Constantinople by Sultan Mehmed the Conqueror. The second phase of the Greek-Turkish relations, as seen by the narratives, of course, not by by historical studies, authoritative studies, is the period 1453 to 1821, the Greek War Revolution, which is portrayed by the Greeks as 400 years of barbaric Turkish yoke, and by the Turks as a case of a model empire which had tolerance, multiculturalism, etc., in which the Greeks, known as the Rum, flourished as no other non-Muslim community. Now, the primordial line is not simply a popular view. It's peddled and presented by the national narratives of either side. In the Greek case, the national narrative is the Paparigopoulos narrative of 3,000 years of uninterrupted Greek history, with its handy Hellenic, Christian, Byzantine synthesis. There are two variants of the Paparigopoulos approach. One is the Neo-Orthodox approach, which puts great emphasis on the Byzantine period and on the Orthodox dimensions of Greek identity. And if you want a more scientific approach, which puts the birth of Hellenism in the Middle Ages, as in the theories of nationalism, this is done by Hastings and Lobera and others, who put the birth of the British, or the English rather, French and other nations in the Middle Ages, in the late Middle Ages. And this approach would put the birth of Hellenism in 1204, which is the Crusader conquest of Constantinople. Now, contrary to the fortunate Greeks, if you want, the Turks lack one dominant narrative, but have at least four competing narrations. The Turkish history thesis, concocted by lesser historians under the guidance of Kemal Atatürk himself in the late 1920s, this Turkish history thesis was officially launched at the 1931 First History Congress in Turkey, which claims that, THT as it's known in Turkey, which claims that the Turks are an ancient people with a glorious civilization of 5 or perhaps even 10,000 years and as the quintessential state builders in the wider region. Then there's the Turkish Islamic synthesis of historian Kafesoglu and others that links Turkism with Islam and the Grand Ottoman Empire. Then there's the Turkic or Pan-Turkic line, initially a line taken by the fathers of Turkish nationalism, Akçuray, Gökalp, which in the late 30s became very racist and so on, and continues to be racist and extreme nationalist. And there's a fourth, there are a number of others, but there's basically it's four other basic narratives. And the fourth is the what could be called the Anatolian thesis, which claims that the present-day Turks are the descendants of all the civilizations that lived and flourished in Anatolia from the ancient days until the present. Now, in spite of certain disagreements between the Paparigopoulos grand narrative and its two variants, almost all Greeks believe that they are heirs to a long, uninterrupted, illustrious history, that the modern Greeks are direct descendants of the ancient Greeks, and that the Turks are the traditional, implacable enemy and remain barbarians till this day. As regards the Turkish narratives, because there are narratives, not one, they disagree on several important points, on whether the Ottoman Empire was a great achievement, Turkish, or a shame to Turkish, but they agree on one point, that it was tolerant of other religious communities and ethnicities, a paradise of cultural pluralism, so much so that the Greeks and Armenians, the Rum, as they are called, thrived even more than the Muslims in the vast empire. Furthermore, all the Turkish narratives, with the partial exception of Anatolianism, slight and demonize the Greeks. Now, to further illustrate the point about narratives playing a decisive role, I will try to portray the dominant views, the dominant narratives regarding ourselves and the other side in the Greek-Turkish case. Now, the Greek narrative regarding the Turks runs as follows. And this comes through school books, and not only school books, but through every kind of commemoration and so on. Now, speeches, the press, and so on, through at least at the level of political socialization in both countries. Now, the Greek narrative is the following. They, the Turks, are the worst and most vicious enemies imaginable. They are invaders. They have taken our ancestral lands and remain barbarians till this day. When they finally defeated our glorious thousand-year Byzantine Empire in 1453, they subjected us Greeks to ill treatment for 400 years until we were finally able to partly free ourselves after a heroic struggle from 1821 to 1829, despite the Turkish ferocity and innumerable slaughters of Greece from Constantinople to Chios and from Psara to Messalonia. Then at last we were able to follow our destiny, civilized Europe, which owes its civilization to us Greeks in the first place. From the 1850s onwards, we tried to liberate other Greek ancestral lands and were successful in liberating Thessaly and most of Epirus, Macedonia, and Thrace. We tried to liberate Ionia, that is Western Asia Minor, but were finally driven out by the Turks and their foreign supporters. This was done with great savagery, atrocities, slaughters, burning of Smyrna, followed by forced labor of the able-bodied who remained there in Anatolia, a drama which ended up with almost 1.5 million deported from their ancestral lands. In the last decades, the aim of inherently expansionist and aggressive Turkey is to grab as much of Cyprus as possible. the expression regarding Cyprus is invasion and occupation of 1974, which is considered almost as tragic as the events of 1922. And also to get hold of east of the eastern Greek islands and Greek Thrace, but the refrains that follow, we would not allow this to happen, for after all, justice and international law is on our side. I need some water between the two narratives. Now, the reason being, I should be equally convincing when I present the Turkish part. I present it in first person, so it will be more vivid. Now, the Turkish narrative regarding the Turks runs as follows. The modern Greeks, Yunnan or Rum, are descendants of a motley group of Christians living under the shrinking Byzantine Empire, an empire that was decadent, tyrannical, uncivilized, and it was in no way related to the ancient Greeks. When we conquered the Rum, Christian Orthodox, they were brought under the just and multicultural rule of our Ottoman Empire, whence they thrived. Yet, ungratefully, the Rum ended up by rebelling with foreign connivance against us, who were their benefactors. We had saved them from Catholicism. In their unlawful rebellion, they committed an array of slaughters. The slaughters during the siege of Tripolitsa and the killing of every Muslim man, woman, or child in the Morea, and have ever since attacked us, trying to extract territories along the infamous Megali Idea, the great idea, the Greek irredentism of the second half of the 19th century and up till 1922, always with the support of the Europeans. They went as far as occupying and invading our Anatolian homeland. Here the expression is the reverse to the one of Cyprus, it's occupation and invasion. Committing atrocities and burning from wherever they went to be fully driven out in our epic liberation war of 1919-22. The more recent exploits of Greece as a revisionist state are its attempt to grab the whole of Cyprus. Until 1974, killing Turkish Cypriots and putting terrible pressure against them when they lived cramped in enclaves. Though they tried to get Cyprus, though Cyprus was never part of a Greek state. And they have, ever since 1973, tried to expand piecemeal in the Aegean by legalistic stratagems so as to render it a Greek lake. But the Greeks will not succeed in their devious schemes, for justice is on our side, and after all, we are a big and powerful country. Needless to say, much of this narrative is a later day construction, barely a century old. That one could make the case that to a considerable degree, or at least to a certain extent, there was a level of cohabitation between the two basically religious groups, who later on became nations, and there was even an element of what could be called a common, to some extent, Ottoman Levantine heritage, which was present in the Balkans and the Asia Minor, which is now a lost world, which ended dramatically within 12 years, from 1912 until 1923. Hercules Milas, which I mentioned before, who is a pioneer in the field of identity as the main issue at stake in the Greek-Turkish rivalry, says that due to historical reasons, each party conceives the other as a prospective threat or as a challenge to its identity, and interprets each of its actions accordingly, creating a vicious circle. The American of Turkish Cypriot extraction social psychoanalyst Vamik Volkan says that by portraying the other side as evil and full of negative traits, one projects those parts of oneself that he/she tries to deny. Projection serves to enhance self-esteem in contrast to the despicable other. In this context, Greeks and Turks have become, says Volkan, the significant negative other. They need each other, but as enemies. One could, what comes to mind is the famous verse of Constantine Cavafy. What will become of us without barbarians? These people were a kind of solution. Moreover, one could perhaps make the following point, that the Greek-Turkish rivalry, if not antagonism, seems to have a positive function along the Simmel-Koser postulate. External threat breeds internal cohesion. It is also worth stressing that the enduring Greek-Turkish rivalry is one of the very few instances in history when two nations, two peoples, earned their independence after a heroic struggle against the other. The only case that comes to my mind, but I should do a bit more research on that, is the Russian-Polish case, which seems to have this element of independence against the other, both becoming independent against the other. This goes a long way to explaining the tenacity of the whole antagonism. Now, I will go on and make some more further points about the Greek identity and the demonization of the Turks and why this is the case, and then why is this the case with the Turkish identity and the demonization of the Greeks. Now, in the Greek case, the negative image of the Turk as backward, barbarian, prone to committing atrocities is an essential ingredient of the Greek self-image and identity. The objective is oblivion. In particular, the yoke occupation notion is essential so as to expunge any hint of coexistence and almost partnership between Muslim Ottoman states under Ottoman rule. Any questioning of the yoke idea, which has come up again and again with new school books in the primary and secondary schools in Greece, any change which portrays the Ottoman Empire as hardly a case of a yoke and much more tolerant and so on, creates a great upheaval in Greece, it creates an uproar, for it is seen as undermining the raison d'etre of Greek national independence and statehood. The urge to present the Turks as the antipode of civilization is above all, it seems to be, not only to me but to a number of others, that by claiming direct descent from the classics, the ancient Greeks, the modern day Greeks become one with the cradle of civilization. And via the ancient Greek connection, part and parcel of European civilization and culture. As the late Stefan Gerasimos had put it, he was a Greek who lived in Istanbul, in order to sustain the major argument of being the defenders of civilization, they, the Greeks, must convince themselves and the world of the barbarism of the other, the inaptitude of the Turks to civilization. Greece is self-defined as the quintessential country of civilization and history. The end result of this self-identity is haughty cultural arrogance, a megalomania that knows few bounds. This sense of superiority, in fact, conceals an existential insecurity that breeds a defensive nationalism. By having chosen to identify themselves with the ancient Greeks, as well as with the major European civilizations, instead of peoples of their own size, as far as population-wise and the size of the state, the Greeks, as a result, feel by comparison miserable. This is combined with an acute feeling of being alone in the world, of being a brotherless nation, an ethnos, another. Even though Greece is in the EU, Most Greeks feel constantly threatened by outside forces, foremost of all by Turkey, which inter alia is seen as having created a menacing Muslim arc in the Balkans against Greece. The other neighbors of Greece are hardly less hostile most of the time, the exception being Bulgaria. A popular belief has it that the Americans, the British, and the other Western Europeans, with the Germans recently joining the fray, are constantly preoccupied with Greece and in the business of conspiring to injure Hellenism. The injustice of it all, according to the great majority of Greeks, is that instead of being admired, cherished, and almost The injustice of it all, according to the great majority of Greeks, is that instead of being admired and always supported by virtue of being the descendants of the original civilizers, the opposite is the case. As for the Turks, they are the favorite child of the Americans and of several Western Europeans. Now, going on to the Turkish item. The Turks return the Greek compliment regarding barbarity and backwardness. Familiar Turkish images, such as Morea in 1821, come to mind, as well as the fate of the Turkish Cypriots at the hands of Makarios and Grivas. Greek society is depicted as ultra-nationalist. The Greeks suffer from a deep-seated neurosis towards the Greeks and a pathological enmity. The Greek state is run by the backward Greek church and its obscurantist priests, a church which was the bastion of the Megalidea and still remains the bastion of the Megalidea. One of the things that came to the fore about 6 or 7 years ago, and it was something that I was, when I went to Turkey, I've gone many times to Turkey, I was asked, is the fact that the Church of Greece has as its flag the two-headed eagle. And so, by definition, this was regarded as, the hidden agenda, or not very hidden agenda, of the Greek Church, to recreate the Byzantine Empire as a Greek empire. Now, the main Turkish concern, however, which is a cause of intense anxiety and has a bearing on Turkish self-identity, is holding on to their territory and sovereignty. Even though they have lived in the region for centuries as Ottomans and then as Turks, they have a sense of not being an indigenous element of the region, but the latest comers in this part of the world. As in the early days of Turkish nationalism, even today, many Turks continue to regard the steppes of Central Asia as homeland. Moreover, the Turks are seemingly more insecure than the Greeks as to their national identity, because their sense of identity evolved belatedly, at least 100 years after the Greeks, and they were, contrary to the Greeks, who were a nation, if you want, in search of a state, they were a state in search of a nation. But the greatest Turkish trauma is the loss of empire, which, with the first blow against the Ottomans, coming actually from the Greek War of Independence, which was the first blow, which then led to the gradual crumbling of the empire. And there's the 19, then part of this loss of the empire is then the 1920 Sevres Treaty comes in, which is the harsh and unfair carving up of Anatolia proper at the Paris Peace Conference. And this was coupled by the invasion of the Greek army, invasion and occupation, as I said, with Allied approval in the Turkish heartland. This has given rise to the Sevres syndrome, the fear of amputation and dismemberment of the motherland, which is regarded even today as the hidden agenda of the Greeks, but also of many Europeans. In this light, EU membership is regarded by some or many in Turkey, and at least by the extreme nationalist parties, as catastrophic. So they would argue that Turkey should not be part of the European Union. As in the Greek case, Turkish narratives are not devoid of megalomania, as seen especially with the Turkish history thesis and the various geopolitical imagination of hardliners, including, I would add, Davutoglu's theory of strategic depth. Turkey's arrogance is mainly the arrogance of power by comparison to other smaller neighboring states, such as Greece. This attitude may be due in part to the gravitas of the imperial past and also due to Turkey's sheer size, military prowess, and geopolitical clout. This sense of superiority conceals a sense of inferiority, as in the Greek case, almost of powerlessness. Apart from the almost paranoiac fear of amputation, the Turks, like the Greeks, are prone to believe in elaborate conspiracy theories depicting a world ganging up upon them, as my friend Kemal Kirishki of Bogazici University has put it. They are convinced that they have no ally worldwide, even though they have Turkey brethren across Asia. The Turks have no friends is a well-known Turkish saying, and a Kurdish one for that matter. Turkey is surrounded by evil enemies in what is a very difficult neighborhood. This could be a Greek expression as well. It's exactly what the Greeks say. They're in a difficult neighborhood. And they would prefer to be in Denmark, but though it's a bit cold there. The counterpart of the Muslim art in the Balkans of the Greeks is the notion of Orthodox encirclement by Greeks and its various allies who happen to be Orthodox. In one of my first trips when I went to Turkey, I had a discussion with a Turkish academic, and she told me that, in fact, I was late 90s, before the thaw of 1990, it was 97, 98, that they were encouraged by one particular source, the army, to have various essays and master's theses by students of IR that would be devoted on the Orthodox encirclement. More generally, the majority of Turks feel that they remain the hated other of Europe, as was the case during the Enlightenment. They remain the abominable Great Turk, contrary to the Greeks, who are the spoiled child of Europe. Now, there are a number of other points that one could make, and I would just have 5 minutes or not? Yeah. Well, there are some additional caveats that could be made. Now, the two sides regard the others as the enemy par excellence. However, there are some differences. In Greece, the Greeks are mesmerized by the Turkish threat. In the Turkish case, this is more nuanced. The basic feeling or the threat perception on the part of Turkey is that Greece is supported by Europe and other countries, has a better image internationally, and the Greek diaspora, particularly the one in the United States, is omnipresent and very powerful and can do grave damage to Turkey. Looking at Turkish texts, but it's something that I must do in greater detail. Next month I'll be in Turkey for a month. It's part of a field study that the observatory has permitted me to take advantage of. I will try and go to greater length and depth as to whether the Turkish position about the Greeks being basically a nuisance and not so much a threat is correct or not. My feeling is that The Greek sense of threat is more at the military level, as far as Turkey is concerned, and on the part of Turkey, it's more at the influence and diplomatic level. When it comes to real military threat, Turkey is more fearful of an internal enemy, the PKK. But here, the Greek connection again comes in. Alleged Greek support for the PKK, at least until 1999. Now, obviously, any change in Greek-Turkish relations has to be a change of the national narratives, secondary education, and so on. But this is an almost impossible task, I would say, for a more likable, worthy of respect and recognition other is very difficult, for it would undermine our, the Greek and Turkish, cherished but insecure sense of identity. Hence, a formal attack on identities perhaps is not very advisable. One could try more partial, gradual changes of the enemy image by greater contacts, the hope that familiarity would lead to better relations. Of course, in many instances, as we know, familiarity breeds contempt. Regarding contacts and greater familiarity, perhaps the Greek reaction to the August 99 earthquake in Izmit might provide a clue. All of a sudden, the image of the Turk, which has a huge mustache and a hanjar, a big sword and so on, disappeared, for the Greeks realized that the Turks are, after all, human beings, and are human beings likely to cry and suffer and so on, and this actually blurred the initial image of the Turk. My impression, and I've got this from an article I read back in the Journal of Conflict Resolution in the 70s, it was, is that the image of the Turk, like the image of the Greek to the Turk, was so extreme and so unreal that any contact with the real Greek or Turk would have made the difference. I will conclude by simply since I implied that the conflict or the rivalry is very difficult to resolve, and it cannot change and so on, it's almost as, I seem almost hawkish in my approach, if you want, I will mention six strategies that could be used to change the extreme demonization on either side. In an original poll, I had used three of these strategies in an article of mine back in 1989 dealing with the Arab-Israeli conflict. Now, in order to move away from the Carl Schmitt approach of the other as the eternal or the constant enemy, one could devise this six-pronged strategy. One is to show how factually erroneous are certain perceptions of the other side in concrete cases, be it in the past or in the present. Secondly, to reveal the other side's suspicions and paranoid fears of us, and then compare them with our fears, thereby amply revealing similarities and subtle differences. I would add, slightly on an ironic, more ironically, that by showing out how threatening our side is to the other, this would perhaps reinforce our collective ego, indicating how threatening one can be to the other. Three, to elaborate on the various mutual misperceptions, I hope the noise I'm hearing is not from MIT and AID, the two secret agencies of my country, of our two countries. Now, to elaborate on the various mutual misperceptions, and actually, when we were trying to forge some kind of dialogue with Turkish academics back in the mid-90s and late 90s, before the rapprochement of 1999, we almost felt the two secret services of the two countries following us. I am almost certain that my telephone is staffed, or it used to be. Now I'm not that important. Now, let me go back to more serious business. Now, the third is to elaborate. The third one is quite. The third one is very interesting because it goes back to the theories of misperception elaborated by Robert Jervis and others in the late 70s when I was studying my PhD. So, way back. Now, one could elaborate on various very common misperceptions of the other side. And one of the most common misperceptions is that the other side is very competent, has a great diplomatic service. Diplomats are fantastic and unique, and that the other party has a well-orchestrated, well-organized master plan to overcome us. This is one of the most common misconceptions mentioned by Jervis and others. And this applies very much in the Turkish case. I have always great difficulty convincing my students that the Turkish diplomats, academics, and so on regard the Greek diplomats are very able. We have at least one diplomat here. My Greek students cannot believe it because they consider the Turkish diplomats as great and fantastic, while the Greek diplomats well below mediocre. Another strategy would be to mention the malign influence of the press and the media in both countries, and in particular this element of selectivity, present something very selectively, only the hawkish or very confrontational aspect of another, of a statement, rather than its more conciliatory part of a statement. Another would be the security dilemma, the fact that armaments and so on are in place for defensive purposes, and despite that, they are seen as offensive in nature. This thing has come out in recent literature in the last 7 or 8 years, the security dilemma, in the Aegean in particular. And the final approach of this six-pronged strategy that I proposed is to elaborate on the destructive role of groupthink when hawkish views are prevailing, and the danger of the famous self-fulfilling prophecy, the concept that Robert Merton brought out in the early 40s in sociology. That when and what happens with self-fulfilling prophecy, there can be self-fulfilling prophecy if you constantly follow a worst-cost scenario. Thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you very, very much, Alexis. We now have about 30 to 35 minutes for questions, so anyone has anything that they'd like to raise?
Stefan Skosikas from Goldman's College. I have actually two questions. The first is, during the government of New Democracy, there was a mixed commission to study the and rewrite history books, textbooks for the schools, in which Thanos Veremis, for example, as far as I know, participated. Can you tell us a few words about, you know, the work of this committee so far? And secondly, my second question is, if we adopt this cohesion approach that both countries, they were looking to find an enemy in order to achieve internal cohesion, how do we explain then the fact that bilateral relations were fairly good from 1932 until the end of the Second World War, when population exchange happened and both countries, they had to achieve some sort of cohesion at that point internally, but their relations were good. They were not looking for an enemy. They were very, very well. Thank you.
Shall I react?
Yes, yes.
Now, as for the mixed commission, it's good you raised that. In 1999 there was something like 9 or 10 agreements signed between the two countries. Until then there were 2 or 3. I mean, imagine they were neighbors and they had only 2 or 3 agreements that had actually lapsed. And there were some about 10 or 12 agreements within the space of 6 months. And one of them was an agreement on had to do with education, culture, and so on. And in that agreement, there was one article or paragraph or whatever which specifically mentioned that there should be mixed commissions, as you said, and that they had to change the school books, the extreme strange statements and those that depicted the other side as despicable and so on. What happened was the following. The mixed committee, after great difficulty, particularly on the part of Greece, I must state that, I have inside information on this, had great difficulty. In fact, the original agreement was the last signed by Greece, not signed, but ratified, took some time because of this particular mention. And I didn't know that Veremis participated. If I did, I would have asked them. We're close friends. But a number of other participants whom I talked to, they told me that nothing has come out of it, and it has not moved very far. And they have rarely met the two committees. In fact, most of the meetings have taken place separately. So apparently, not much has come out of this. Of course, this goes back to, and another little thing, because I was following this very closely in the early 2000s, was that a number of otherwise very sanguine people, very moderate and so on, such as the late Ambassador Byron Theodoropoulos, who has spoken to meetings here, he died last year. Now, Theodoropoulos had come out saying that who will tamper with our history? So there was this kind of thing, that you cannot tamper with the history, and how history should be written. Now, your other question, which is more difficult to answer, in fact, this cohesion thing was a sort of cursory remark on my side. I wasn't prepared to really defend it, if you want, but one could play around with this concept in the following terms. The external threat back in the 30s was from Italy and Bulgaria, for both Greece and Turkey, who were status quo countries. So that external threat brought them together. I'm not saying something, I've not sort of invented the wheel. This is something that is mentioned by specialists of Greek-Turkish relations in the 30s. They come up very much with this element, that in that case, the external threat brought the two together and closer to Britain. Now, in this case, one should make a clear distinction, I think, between the external threat bringing internal cohesion. If this is done, it's simply a function which is not deliberate, or if it's done deliberately, because that's another matter. And it could be done deliberately by some governments and some willy statesmen of the type, for example, Andreas Papandreou. It would not be beyond him to really concoct this thing and create it.
Yes.
Well,
what about what you might mean by internal cohesion? What I would guess it means is sovereign. Because I think it was in London at that conference, and you find Turkey's problem as being sovereignty, sovereignty, sovereignty. And that's been Greece's problem too, hasn't it? The authenticity of sovereignty. And these two societies have faced the same challenges from the 1820s through. And in a way, the versions of narratives are very interesting and suggestive, but they're not the heart of the matter, are they? I suspect it's state-building, issues of sovereignty, challenges of sovereignty. And if you put those two experiences alongside each other, well, we'll begin to penetrate what's really at issue in both these societies. But the narratives in the end, surely, are superficial.
Well, this might be the case, but that's not what I had in mind, but it could. I would, sort of think of what you said and see how it can make sense of what I'm doing. What I had in mind is the following, that the threat from without has been mentioned as one of the main reasons for the creation of a nation. to give you some concrete examples, that comes from the literature on nationalism, by the way. The threat from France created the German nation. Herder, Fichte, and so on, and they, at some point, of course, united. The threat from the Austrians created the Italian nation. The threat from the Serbs and Greeks created the Albanian nation. The threat from the Croatians and the Serbs created the Bosnian nation. The threat from the Greeks, Bulgarians, and others created the Turkish nation, and so on. So I had this feeling, and the threat from the Israelis created the Palestinian people or nation. There's a long discussion among Arabists about whether you have an Arab nation or separate Arab nations. But whatever, if there were no Israelis, if you want, threatening the Palestinians, there would not have been a separate Palestinian people, but they would have been Palestinian Arabs, and they would have been dispersed all over the Arab world and not tried to maintain and go back to their homeland. So that was basically what I had in mind, that the creation of a cohesive whole, a common we feeling, a common spirit of wanting to struggle together and so on.
Thank you. Two separate questions, please. I would be interested to know if there is another country that views Greece and or Turkey in the way that they've been depicted by each other, if that makes sense. In other words, are there 50 other nations that regard Turkey the way they've been depicted perhaps by the Greeks, and are there the same amount that regard the Greeks in the same way? Because I don't believe it's just the two that regard each other that way. Completely separate question. I wondered what has really radically changed since the Rapprochement of 99, and I refer specifically to what one would have hoped would have been a bigger encouragement on the part of Greece to help Turkey get away from the intransigence of the Cyprus issue. That we've had sort of 12 years since then. But sadly, Turkey is in no hurry to solve the Cyprus issue. And I just wondered how much encouragement you believe there is on the part of Greece, and what actual power there would be for them to encourage Turkey.
Well, was your first question whether we have other, let's say, pairs of states or adversaries who...
No, in other words,
all pairs regard the other as a demon. Sorry.
Yeah, no. In other words, how do other countries view Turkey?
How do other countries view Greece? Well, there are various approaches. One tendency is to share, to some extent, the Turkish view. The other is to share the Greek view. And the most common approach is the one in Romeo and Juliet, to hell with both their houses. Entre nous, I might agree to some extent, but that's between us. Let's keep it a secret.
Second question.
Now, I tried to avoid the second question because I totally disagreed with you, but let me go ahead. No, I wouldn't have. No, I'm joking. Now, I don't see how the Greeks convinced the Turks to make this huge U-turn, 180-degree turn on the Cypriot issue. I think it had to do first with the fact that they wanted to be part of Europe, so they had to change their tune. That's one element. The other was that perhaps at some point it dawned upon them that the intransigence of Deng Tash was not leading anywhere. In fact, it was also closing their door to the EU. And there was something else, the Turkish Cypriots themselves, the indigenous Turkish Cypriots that took to the streets and wanted a resolution of the Cyprus problem and a reunification. And it seems to that in general, and if you look at the texts written by academics and other and people like Mehmet Ali Birand and many others in the Turkish newspapers in the early 2000s, there was an increasing criticism of this taboo issue. Previously, the Cyprus question was a taboo. It was considered resolved in 1974. To my mind, at least, this was an internal affair for Turkey, and Greece was hardly in a position to make Turkey more let's say, sensible. So I happen to disagree with what you're saying. So that's my own point. By the way, I have been studying the separatist issue for some time, and I think that, like in the case of, let's say, Russia's dissolution, if you talk to Russians, they would say that it was their own affair and it was their own decision. They were not really pushed to that dissolution and to the change that took place. But I may be wrong.
Sure.
It's an assessment.
I just want to make sure I have understood your argument. You're saying that it is not history per se, but it is the present reconstruction of history that is keeping these two countries apart.
Yes.
And just as a wishful suggestion, I mean, if you look in history, you look at the French and the Germans, and say after the end of World War II, they were divided, perhaps with a lot more history than the Turks and the Greeks had been divided. But they found a way. They found a way what to use the present to reconstruct that history.
Yeah, but I mean, could I react? But a cynic would say that, yes, you needed a huge war for them to come to their senses. In some degree, this happened in 1922. There was the war, and they were more able to make the historical compromise, which is not the case now. It's one of the subjects that I put forward to my students and say, why don't you compare the two? And the thing that they immediately come up with is that, well, the Germans and the French, they are both Christians, etc. They were never one country, like the Ottoman Empire, which included also the Greeks in high positions and so on. So they don't have that many skeletons in the cupboard. Of course, you know, my reaction would be, if you go back in history, the Franks were Germans and so on, and the Asterix and the Gauls more or less disappeared. But they were separate states, and as separate states, if you go back to sovereignty and so on, they felt secure enough to be able to... By the way, in the German-French case, there is a commission going back to, I think, the 50s, which has rewritten the school books, and made sure that no abusive terms have appeared in it. But I mean, obviously, that's one obvious thing. I mean, it has to be made clear. I mean, to what extent the school books in the second part of the 19th century and early 20th century in France and Germany were really perhaps even worse than the Greek school books against the Turks. I mean, there was really a huge. Verbal attack on either side, which is not known that much to be able to convey it.
Yes. Christofidis from Cyprus, High Commission here in London. First of all, just to say I totally agree with you about the comment you made about the Annan plan, for example, 2004, replying to the question previously put. Greece did not really convince Turkey to be in favor of that plan. I fully agree with you. I know we disagree very much on that. I follow your articles in the Greek press on the Annan plan. I know how much you appreciate and value that plan. But on the other hand, one has to read, I think, at least personally, objectively, that Turkey really wanted that plan, asked the Turkish Cypriots to vote in favor because it really fit here for all its purpose, strategic interests. You mentioned also the Turkish Cypriots in the streets. It wasn't exactly true. The Turkish Cypriots were in the streets wanting to join the European Union also. They are now in the streets again against Turkey, and the reply they got from Davutoglu himself, he repeated what he wrote in his book, that even if there was not a single Turkish Cypriot in Cyprus, we should have invented him. That's for sure. And that explains a lot. Coming back to your presentation, very amusing, especially the narrative. If one really goes with it, it would be really depressed. I mean, I don't know what would really change. I really hope the six strategies you have proposed could really tackle the whole issue. But in my mind, the only thing to really solve the problem, if the narrative is true on both sides, is to have a massive group therapy in both nations, really, and in Cyprus especially. But don't quote me on that. But anyways, I really disagree, because I think that is an impression of the past. I don't think nowadays the majority of the Greeks or the majority of the Turks really believe, have this image of the other as you have described it. At least this is not, even in Cyprus where the tensions are high and all that, we have passed that long way, we have come a long way now. And I don't believe this narrative, as amusing as it is the truth, it is reflecting the majority of people. I know that this narrative, as impressive as it was presented by you, gives, you know, get the headlines, it's in the headlines, but it's not really true. I mean, we're in 2011, and it's not like that. I know my mother is watching Turkish soap opera and doesn't believe that, she's a refugee in Cyprus, and she doesn't believe that the Turks are like that. This comment on the way
I would agree to the extent that, I mean, if what I presented was representative of 95 or 99% of the people until 99, now it might represent 70% or something like that. No, what I have in mind in the Greek case is the great uproar when there was these two changes of books. There was first of all a book that presented the Ottoman Empire as more on the basis of historical fact. It didn't go that far, in fact, but it still presented the Ottoman Empire as a case of a tolerant empire, much more than any other empire in the world in those days, I mean, as regards ethnicities and that. And when this created an uproar, and those of us that dared write articles or speak in the television were attacked again and again. And this happened a second time, with the case of Thanos Veremis, and we were coming from Cyprus a month ago on the same plane, and he was explaining what happened. He has come up with a TV presentation of the Greek War of Independence. But in order to come to that, he has to have some backward information with regard to the Ottoman Empire. And the fact that he mentioned something in a not something in a less favorable, not unfavorable light with regard to the Ottoman Empire, created an uproar. On the other hand, he tells me that because there's a discussion, because this is a sort of a serial which is presented in 10 or 15 different series, and there's a huge discussion after that. But again, it has created an uproar, and some people say that it should be not be continued, discontinued, and so on. And I think, I'm not that sure, I would hope that you are right. Let me put it differently. More sophisticated people, like you, for example, and like those of us in the room, would be prepared to see this, or would perhaps even laugh at some of the extremes. On the other hand, there's another element that we should bear in mind. Most of what is said here, as far as slaughtering is concerned and so on, was real enough. But the only difference is that you sort of look at only part of it. You sort of put something over here, and you look only at your people who were slaughtered by the other side, and you forget what was happening. I don't want to go into my own personal experience, but on Greek television 2 years ago, I dared say about the Greek atrocities in Asia Minor. I was attacked again and again in the press, and even the right-wing party, the extreme right-wing party in parliament, attacked me and questioned and asked, I mean, said, how can I be a university professor, and so on. And the reply of the education minister was that we disagree with what he's saying, right? But we cannot become involved because it's the freedom of expression. So my personal experience says otherwise, but one should, move beyond his personal experience, I must say. But I would hope that you're right.
You more or less answered my first point, really, which is that in cases of apparent, at any rate, paranoia, as Freud steps so long ago now, there's always a kernel of truth. And that's one of the complexities, isn't it? Mm. There have been disasters, because it true that, you know, this, that, that. But as you say, it's taking something only partly. I was just thinking that one of your suggestions was, of course, that we need more facts, don't we? Just to start with, just basic facts, figures, events, you know. Uninterpretative history, if you like, just a sort of. And yet again, that would not be enough at all. Because there's knowing and knowing, as I'm sure you know. You may know the facts, but I have the impression, certainly it's not an impression, it's an observation, if you like, from Cyprus, which where I come from, that people might even know things, and yet emotionally they do not know them. They do not feel them, and they discard them. So, a Greek Cypriot may know that, yes, there was much support of Turkish Cypriots, but it doesn't really register emotionally with them. And I've seen the same on the other side. So it's a huge battle, really, to wrong word. You know, it takes a huge effort to actually change, truly shift things. And the other thing is that, yes, your mother may be watching this, and my mother is as well, and all this. And there's a lot of that going on in Cyprus. But if there was a crisis, it's just a surface that you scratch and you'll see this other thing come up. I have no doubt about it. People will regress back to they are barbaric, they are this, they are that, they are like that.
Would I believe, if I may just say that? Yes, but if there is a crisis in any other part of the world, between any other two nations, about one thing, it would be the same.
Yes,
it's not because of the psychology that would come out, your bad self.
Absolutely. It would be the same. What I'm saying is that we must not believe that everything is fine, you know, everything is much better now. Because it isn't, it is.
It's not all psychological, that's what I tried to.
Nobody's saying it's all psychological.
Yeah, I want to react. I would agree with you, definitely. But one of the things that you mentioned about, in every other case, it would be the same. In every other colony, be it in Sri Lanka, between the Tamils and the Sinhalese, etc., in Kashmir, or among the Israelis and the Palestinians, or the southern Sudanese and the Sudanese, and so on, or the Serbs and the Kosovars, or the Croats and the Serbs in the 90s. One of the things which I found quite interesting is whenever I try to present, be it in the case of the Serbs or the Kosovars or the Palestinians and the Israelis, in two concrete cases, whenever I try, or the Greek Cypriots and the Turkish Cypriots, that, well, there are ways out, this can be resolved, and I mentioned a number of other examples, the classic sort of gut reaction is the following. No, they are unique. They are the worst enemy possible. And our case is unsolvable because we can never trust them. I mean, the Serbs are not that bad as the Kosovars consider, and the other way around. But in our case, we have the most abominable enemy imaginable. And it's this sense of uniqueness.
Gentlemen, Harvard by University of London. Given the analogy that the Balkans and the Aegean is one big playground. You got a lot of little kids, and then you got Turkey, which is a big kid, and Turkey's kind of been excluded from the big EU club. Once that hopes of Turkey joining the EU fade, which they are, and they're moving more eastwards, and the move towards European countries is towards not accepting them, Turkey's been playing nice so far with Greece. Once that goes, that carrot goes of EU membership, how do you feel the relationship will actually evolve? Once Turkey realizes there's no point being nice, they can might as well do what they're going to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, this is something to worry about. Although my feeling is that Turkey doesn't need the carrot to behave. I mean, Turkey might take another view, and I think that's what Davutoglu is about. Not on the basis of his book, which is not very convincing as a scholarly book, but it might prefer to have the role of a responsible state, which is not, let's say, aggressive and so on towards its neighbors. And it might simply find out that this is more to its interests. To give you the example of, the case of Germany attacks from the days of Wilhelm II, until you have Adolf Hitler. In fact, I've been told by German friends that almost nobody's named Adolf first or Wilhelm in Germany, or very few are named Wilhelm. But the Germany, which was attacking everybody, I mean, it was trying to expand, ended up being a country which is much smaller than the Germany, the conquered Germany, or rather the defeated Germany in the First World War, and is much better off as a welfare state, if you want, than a garrison state. So my own argument towards the Greeks, you know, because I have to play this role as well in a patron academic, is that, look, the argument which I use against the realists, academics and others, is that you should not wait for Turkey to enter the EU or try to enter and so on and become not a sacrificial lamb, but in any event, much more less assertive and much more amenable to whatever. And that, in fact, they should clinch a deal now with Turkey and realize that Turkey also has very good arguments in the Aegean, I would say, and in Cyprus, for that matter. Create a consociational type of framework within Cyprus. So I think that what I'm driving at is a number of Turkish academic friends of mine, whom I'm going to meet next week, point out to me, but although I'm not totally convinced, they have to convince me, is that Turkey had this approach, sort of strategic, realist approach in the 1990s. Afterwards, after having been more sort of enmeshed and more involved in Balkan politics with its peace forces and so on, there was a greater sense of self-confidence, and that's what's one reason why Davutoglu speaks in terms of, no zero enemies and so on. So, and at the end of the day, we have to accept that Turkey. The Turkey, which is outside the EU, we have kind of special relationship, I suppose, and hope that Turkey is not the Turkey of whatever. But the Turkey of Özal wasn't that bad either, but Greece did not take the opportunity, did not grasp the opportunity, because Andreas Papandreou was there. I have this thing with Andreas Papandreou.
We're almost out of time, but I've got one final question there.
Hi. From the Greek perspective, there have been several hostile incidents when it comes to Turks, like Imia, the Severan Bridge of the national Greek border. So I think it's justifiable for the Greeks to see the Turks as a threat or as an enemy. But on the other hand, we don't have any hostile incidents, at least in the recent years, from the Greek side to Turkey's. So I don't see how the Turkish can say Greek as a threat rather as a nuisance.
Yeah, I mean, this is...
justifiable for Greeks to see Turks as a threat.
You confirm my overall approach as far as the Greeks are concerned, that they regard Turkey as a threat. An even greater argument, which would have made what you said more convincing, is that the sheer size of Turkey. So it's what I sometimes joke with my Balkan friends, that the Greeks are scared stiff of Turkey and the Albanians are scared stiff of the Greeks. So, I mean, it's the one who is bigger and more resourceful and so on might appear threatening to the other side. Now, I mentioned in the last 6 points about concrete facts. If you look in more detail at the case of the two cases that you mentioned, it's arguable whether one was more threatening than the other and one caused problems to the other party. If one looks in detail, you find out that you have what I would say the general thing that came out in the Greek media.
But facts are facts. Fact is that,
no, but
the
that's
Turks
is your
fact. The Turks came to Imia, a Greek land, and they did what they did.
No.
I don't remember any incidents for Greeks going to like Turkish land or somewhere else. Do you
really?
Have one to give us?
Well, Asia Minor in 1992, forget invasion.
I think we're now getting into a territory of, I think as the lens is just highlighted.
I want to clarify one thing. Now, okay, let's stick at this particular example. On the basis of, let's look at the INIA episode for Kardak, that's the treaties, it's not the conventions with the Italians, speak of Kardak, that was the name in those days, in 1931, 1932. Yeah, in December and January. Now, what happened is the Turks were not sure whether that was Greek or Turkish. They thought that it was Turkish because it happened to be nearer to their coast and to their island than to the Greek island. And when this thing happened, which was not premeditated, it simply happened. The Turks tried to find out whether it's Turkish or not. What I will describe to you is what I've been told by eminent academics in Turkey, very pro-Greek and not hawkish in any sense. Now, what happened? The setting was the following: Mrs. Chiller, how you play Mrs. Chiller? Now, Mrs. Chiller is sitting there. Now. And the discussion is the following. What happens? A prime minister has his experts and his diplomats and so on. He has to rely on them for the facts, to use your expression.
He does say
no, please.
It was,
please, hold on. Let explain.
Now, they were trying to get information to see if the island, it's the rocks, basically, the islet was Greek or Turkish. And if it's Greek, they had made a mistake. And the basic question posed by Chiller was that, are we on safe grounds, Mr. Secretary General? Onur Oyman, who was later in the JHP party. And he lied to her. He told her, no, we are on safe grounds. Although the ambassador in Rome, Kemal Kiritsky, has told me that. Who had a friend, an ambassador in Rome. And there was the desk officer who knew about this report from the ambassador in Rome, who said the very contrary, and it was hidden from her. And from then on, Turkey has come up at the level of Secretary General, at the level of Yilmaz, who had headed the opposition, and said that it was a grave mistake on our part, and it should be forgotten. I cannot even convince you with facts. That's a problem.
Alexis, thank you very, very much. Please, that's it. Thank you very, very much for such an interesting question.